Would you like to reserve time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Certainly, you may. And whenever you're ready, I'd be happy to receive your argument.
Thank you very much. May it please the Court, I'm Afshin Farishai. I represent appellant Daniel Anderson. Mr. Anderson was charged with second-degree murder in Virginia Beach Circuit Court. The jury found him guilty of manslaughter. The defense that we raised in this case was a self-defense case. And the issue before the court is the trial court's error in not introducing into evidence most of the prior violent conduct or turbulent conduct on the part of the deceased. And on my brief, I have replicated the piece of evidence that we handed to the trial judge after argument before the trial. At the end of Commonwealth evidence, that the court admitted four of the 10 prior charges, if you will, of the deceased. Our contention is this. In this self-defense case, it's not just the quality of each incident, it's also the quantity. The trial judge should have admitted all 10 for the jury to consider. This was I would submit to you, a close case in the sense that Mr. Anderson was initially charged with second-degree murder.
Counsel, may I interrupt you?
Yes.
But there were several of those charges that were dismissed.
That's correct.
And the record does not indicate why they were dismissed.
Yes.
So how is it that you think that those would have been relevant?
Well, Your Honor, as far as relevance is concerned, I submit to you that, and I think the court is referring to, mainly there were assault charges that were just prior assault charges. It is relevant. If someone who's been arrested for assault, that means that there was some kind of probable cause found at some point when he was arrested. And I would submit to you that's even more compelling evidence than if someone just comes to court and says, hey, the guy who died, he assaulted me, and no charge was taken up. So,
well, counsel, but you had no showing that, in fact, when that was dismissed, that he was the aggressor. The record does not demonstrate that?
No, yeah. We do not have any witnesses come to court to say back in 1996 in Norfolk, this guy assaulted me. That is correct. But my point is this, that, first of all, the case law doesn't say how to prove prior incidents of violent conduct or turbulent conduct on the part of the deceased. So there's no case law that says the other way. Just because it's dismissed doesn't mean that it's not admissible. And it goes really to the weight. The Commonwealth can make that argument.
Is it your argument that simply having the fact that a magistrate issued a warrant is proof that it actually occurred?
That's for the jury to decide. In a self-defense case, as you know, Your Honor, a lot of evidence comes in that normally does not come in. And we're talking about prior instances of conduct.
Even so, if unknown to the defendant.
Yes, sir, exactly. So this is something that the jury has to decide, not the judge. All the judge knows, and the Commonwealth, by the way, everyone agreed that the deceased in this case had been charged.
But my point is, you are entitled to put in evidence of violent acts by the victim. My question is, how does anybody know that what happened back then was, in fact, a violent act when it was ultimately dismissed?
Your Honor, if it goes to my previous statement, the number of charges is relevant here. If we're talking about just one assault and battery charge from 1996 in Norfolk and that was dismissed, I think that's a valid point. But when we're talking about several, in conjunction with everything else that the deceased had, in conjunction with the facts of this case, that's why it's becoming important. So I can similarly say, if a witness comes to court and say, the deceased assaulted me last month, someone can say, well, that is not, how do we know that that really happened? We don't have a conviction, we don't have, but that evidence certainly comes in. So all I'm saying is this, that just because it's dismissed doesn't make it inadmissible. That is an argument, it goes to the weight. That is an argument the Commonwealth can make to the jury. And I'm not saying it's not a good argument. It's certainly a strong argument, but it has nothing to do with relevance, has nothing to do with admissibility. The jury can decide. And the counter argument is telling the jury, you have 10 instances of prior violent, turbulent conduct on the part of the deceased. Contrast that argument with saying, you have 4. I submit to you 10 is much more significant.
There was other evidence. Not only did the jury know of the 2013 assault conviction, the 96 brandishing conviction, the 2012 drunk driving, and public intoxication. But there was also additional evidence regarding the victim's violent and turbulent behavior. The victim's wife described him as a miserable, nasty drunk who drank every day. Neighbor testified that he could be aggressive and he would fight over his girls if someone instigated an altercation. So there was evidence that he was violent, that he was an alcoholic, that he had been convicted of assault. So the issue was, how many times are you entitled to put on additional convictions once that evidence is there?
That's right.
One, three, 10, 20?
My response is as many as there are out there. If I can just present an analogy, when a defendant is charged with petty larceny, third, or subsequent offense, this court has said the Commonwealth can introduce 10 prior convictions if the Commonwealth desires, because the Commonwealth will not know what the jury will think about those convictions when they go in the back and deliberate. And to be consistent with that law, we can't prevent a defendant from introducing additional instances of prior violent, turbulent conduct on the part of the state. So just because there was evidence introduced of the violent or turbulent history of the deceased does not mean that this six instances should not have committed. So we don't know.
The trial court didn't say two is enough, 10 is way too many. He went down the list and said this is relevant, this isn't relevant.
Yes, Your Honor.
The three dismissal charges don't show us anything because it was dismissed. Other charges weren't relevant. So it wasn't that he just said, well, I've heard enough. He gave reasons for each one of the convictions that he didn't allow in.
Yes, Your Honor. And the trial judge did that in disregarding the argument that I made at the trial court, and I'm making it before this court. The number of prior instances of conduct is relevant.
May I interrupt you?
Yes,
I think this will put this issue to bed. counsel was allowed, the court told counsel that if you had witnesses, you could put them on and testify as to those charges. But Mr. Anderson failed to produce witnesses in reference to those dismissed charges. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so doesn't that satisfy that issue clearly?
I would respectfully disagree with that assertion. Here's why. Yes, it would have been great to have six witnesses come to court from 1990s or whatever it was, say, yeah, this guy assaulted me in North Carolina, this guy assaulted me in North Carolina, in Norfolk. That would have been great. But that is not the same thing as saying that's what you require to do. So just because...
Counsel,
yes.
As Judge Frank has said, you've got a cumulative people who have testified that basically he was a nasty drunk and that he drank a liter of Wild Turkey a day. His wife testified against him, and there was even... Mr. Anderson testified that they had a previous very ugly fight problem.
That's right.
So, you know, how can you say that the jury didn't understand that this gentleman could act out?
Yes, sir. Well, Your Honor, I think on the face of it, that's a valid point, but I would just repeat what I said. If I can argue in front of the jury, we have 10 instances of this man being arrested for this and this, as opposed to four. I would submit to you that that's significant, especially in a self-defense case. This court and the Supreme Court of Virginia have taken a very strict view when it comes to self-defense. When a trial judge doesn't allow a certain piece of evidence, doesn't allow some cross-examination, in a jury instruction context, this court and the Supreme Court of Virginia have taken a very strict view of self-defense.
Isn't your bottom line that the trial court erred in finding those charges that he didn't let in relevant? Isn't that his obligation before he lets any evidence in, whether or not it's relevant?
I think that's one way that he erred. Sure, of course. Yes, Your Honor, that is something that was...
Isn't that it?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that it?
I'm afraid to answer that question by saying yes, because I think there's a little bit more to it than that. I think the trial judge, the mistake that the trial judge made, one mistake that he made was he looked at these instances in isolation. And I repeatedly asked the court to not look at this in a vacuum. I repeatedly asked the court to look at this in the context of the entire case. Sure, when you go one by one and say, you know, this is not good, sure, I think you're not gonna miss the big point here. It's just like going through the evidence and saying, well, this piece of evidence introduced by the Commonwealth is not good, this piece of evidence is not good, but then that misses the point. Look at all the evidence and then decide whether or not the person is guilty. Similarly, in this case, in a self-defense case, the defendant should have a lot of leeway, especially when you put it in conjunction with the facts of this case.
What about the convictions for carrying a concealed weapon?
Yes, sir.
Excluded. That could be as simple as he had forgotten to get his concealed weapon permit, or that he was carrying a pocket knife.
Yes. Excellent.
How does that in any way prove that an individual has a violent or turbulent nature?
Yes. Well, Your Honor, first let me just point out that he was convicted of two carrying concealed weapons. And, in fact, I think the second was a felony was reduced to a misdemeanor, but we know he was convicted of two. And I'm sorry, I say convicted. I want to make sure I'm right about that.
How does carrying a concealed
yes.
weapon in any way establish the person is of a violent and turbulent nature?
Well, Your Honor, it goes, there are two ways of self-defense, and they're kind of related. One is who was the primary aggressor, and the other thing is what was the defendant perceiving. So this goes to who could have been the primary aggressor. Again, we cannot look at it in isolation. And we don't know, you're right, we don't know what the facts of the case were. But we do know that in this case, there was a knife, there was an incident with the knife, with the deceased taking out a knife, I think about a year before this incident. And if I can...
Counsel, yes. We also know yeah. that Mr. Anderson had no knowledge of the fact that he'd had the two charges,
yes.
the two convictions of concealed weapons.
Yes, right.
So he couldn't have had any fear in reference to that since he didn't know.
Well, I think I would answer that question this way. First of all, he knew of a prior incident with a knife. And I just want to point this out. I think this addresses another Commonwealth argument. On page 67, and when we were first arguing this issue, I told the trial judge, and it's a little garbled up here, but I told the trial judge that he, being the defendant, knew Mr. Nardo had concealed weapon convictions and also stated to the trial judge, the evidence in this case is going to be that actually Mr. Nardo carried a knife at all times. So, now, I will just say this. I don't know if that's exactly what I said. It doesn't sound like I would exactly say that, but it's in the record, so we'll go with that. So I actually proffered to the trial judge that my client knew he had a prior concealed weapon conviction. Now, I will concede that the evidence didn't show that, and I'm not sure why I said that or why it was. So, but here's my point. The trial judge was given that proffer. So before my client testified, which I think this directly one of the ways that rebuts the Commonwealth's argument that this issue wasn't preserved, but we should renew the motion. But the trial judge, when the trial judge made the ruling, the trial judge was told that my client had knew that the victim had a concealed weapon conviction. Now, again, that's not how the facts turned out later. I mean, there's nothing in the record to say that, but that's what the trial judge was told. So in that regard, certainly the trial judge committed an error. I think I'm going to sit down and
okay.
wait
Thank
for
that.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Rachel Yates on behalf of the Commonwealth. To start with the concealed weapons charges, since that was most recently addressed, in this particular case, Mr. Anderson's concession just now that we don't know that the victim was the aggressor in those charges is controlling in this case. Because we don't know that, and because the burden is on the proponent of the evidence to establish its admissibility and relevance at the time they move to admit the evidence, and that's the Creamer case I cited on brief, because of that, the trial court did not err in excluding it when the trial court was asked to make its ruling. One of the most important things in this case is the circumstances surrounding Mr. Anderson's request to admit these charges. In the first instance, considering the concealed weapons, the trial court said he wanted to hear the evidence before he made a decision. And he specifically took those two charges under advisement to allow the record to develop. And at the time that Mr. Anderson renewed his request to admit the concealed weapons charges. No self-defense claim had been formally established at that point. And that's important because these charges would only be relevant, if ever, if there was a self-defense claim established. So the trial court didn't err when it said, at the time that it was asked to make its decision at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's evidence, the trial court didn't err when it said there's insufficient foundation for their admission at this time. Secondly, Your Honor, even if self-defense had been established, these prior acts of violence or turbulence on the part of the victim could only ever be admitted if one of two things was shown, that it impacted the defendant's reasonable apprehension of the victim, or if it showed the victim was more likely the aggressor. Because Mr. Anderson concedes today that it doesn't show in any way, at least from the face of the charges or the proffer of those charges, who the aggressor was in those circumstances, it cannot be admissible on that basis. Secondly, at the time that the trial court was asked to decide whether to admit those, there was no showing the defendant's reasonable apprehension.
Let me stop you there. I'm having trouble with that. I think the argument is that the convictions don't necessarily show on their face who the aggressor was.
Yes, sir.
But that's not the test. The test is, was the evidence being offered to show in this crime who the aggressor was? So if an individual has been convicted of a violent crime in the past, that's admissible to show that he would more likely be the aggressor in the case for which he's on the trial is being had.
Yes, sir.
But you don't have to prove who was the aggressor in the prior conviction for that to be relevant. That kind of proves itself.
In the sense that it would be self-proving that the victim was the aggressor, then yes, Your Honor, I agree with that. In this case, the other opportunity to introduce the concealed weapon would be to show that the defendant's apprehension of the victim was in some way reasonable. And when the defendant testified, he did say they had this previous altercation with a knife. However, at the time...
That, if it's admitted for that purpose, you have to show that the defendant was aware of the prior instance.
Yes, sir.
And was that done here? Was there any showing that the defendant was aware of any of these prior convictions?
No, sir. And specifically, even at the time that the defendant testified, that was after Mr. Anderson had renewed his request for the court to admit the concealed weapons, and the court said there's not sufficient foundation yet. So at that point, it was premature to ask the court to make that decision if the defense was going to rely on Mr. Anderson's testimony. So because of that, the trial court did not err in finding that there was insufficient foundation to admit the concealed weapons convictions in this case.
Counsel, is there review to determine whether each of these 10 charges, they were relevant to the issue before the court?
I apologize, Your Honor. Could you repeat the question?
Sure. These 10 charges that were proffered, court accepted 4 of them, I believe. Is there review to determine whether the court's ruling on each of these cases, whether that conviction was relevant to the charge before the court?
The trial court was required to determine each piece of evidence individually, whether that each piece was admissible in order to admit the evidence in question. Mr. Anderson today makes an argument that the trial court erred because cumulatively, all of those pieces of evidence in and of themselves make this more relevant. But that's not the question. Just because there's a lot of inadmissible evidence doesn't mean that the trial court needed to admit it. Each piece has to be looked at individually. In this court, the trial court spent, and in this case,
and
the trial court...
His argument was you have to look at the cumulative effect of
yes,
all of these, not each individual conviction.
Yes, Your Honor, and there is no authority for that. Each piece of evidence has to be looked at individually. Well, it might be relevant to a harmless error analysis if the trial court abused its discretion in not admitting all of this. It does not impact its admissibility, the fact that there were 6 pieces of inadmissible evidence moved in this case.
Counsel, those were submitted to the court just on a sheet. Isn't that correct? I mean, you didn't have the actual rulings of the court on those. You just had a sheet with the listed offense and what occurred there.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as I ask Mr. Anderson's counsel, the court said that on those dismissed charges that certainly counsel could call witnesses in reference to those charges, but counsel failed to do that. Mr. Anderson failed to do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Am I correct in that as well?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. So to address the dismissed charges, there's an additional difficulty with regard to those, because Mr. Anderson argues that their fact that the victim in this case was charged with crimes makes it more likely that he committed those crimes or that he was the aggressor in those cases. And that poses a lot of problems in a jury trial. And in this case, there was a jury instruction which specifically told the jury, the presumption of innocence instruction, that the jury can't presume that the defendant committed a crime simply because he is being charged with it. So to tell the jury, on one hand, you can consider the fact that he was this victim was previously charged with something but wasn't found guilty. You can consider that as evidence that he probably did it. To have that being argued on one hand in relation to the fact that the jury is also being told that Mr. Anderson can't be considered, the jury can't consider the fact that Mr. Anderson was indicted with this crime as evidence that he, in fact, did the crime he's on trial for, that poses an additional danger of prejudice to the defense or confusion of the issues for the jury. So there's an additional problem with the dismissed charges. And finally, in terms of the number of charges, in this case, there were four admitted prior bad act pieces of evidence the jury was entitled to hear. Moreover, the victim's wife testified that he was a miserable, nasty drunk, and he was verbally aggressive. The jury heard from the defendant when he testified that they'd had this previous altercation with a knife. The jury heard a great deal of evidence that the victim in this case was a character and had some prior incidents of various problematic conduct. But so the issue was brought to the attention of the jury, and the trial court has trial court has the ability to limit the number of these prior bad act pieces of evidence in order to limit the possible issues in front of the jury. And the question for abuse of discretion is, does the record fairly support the trial court's decision? And the record plainly supports the trial court's decision in this case. In terms of harmless error, for the same reasons the trial court didn't abuse its discretion, there was a harmless error. There was no harmless error in this case, even if the trial court should have admitted this evidence. So for that reason, the Commonwealth asked the court to affirm the judgment below. And I would otherwise rest on my brief if the court doesn't have further questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, 1 minute. Very briefly. The Commonwealth starts out their argument by stating that at the time that the trial judge introduced that evidence, no self-defense claim had been established. Well, under that, if we accept that theory, then none of these convictions or charges should have been admitted. But from the very beginning, I understand Ms. Yates was not the trial counsel, but from the very beginning of the case, the Commonwealth, the court, the defense counsel, everyone agreed this was a self-defense case and went on that assumption. At no point did the Commonwealth say, wait a minute, Judge, there's been no self-defense claim established. But the bigger point is this. Of course there was a self-defense claim established. The Commonwealth witnesses, as Ms. Yates just told you, went through and established that self-defense claim. The Commonwealth star witness established a self-defense claim. So to say, well, that evidence should not have been admitted anyway because no self-defense claim had been established, is just absolutely not correct. And the law is this, and I'm just going to quote from the Barnes case. Where an accused adduces evidence that he acted in self-defense, evidence of specific acts is admissible to show the character of the decedent for turbulence and violence, even if the accused is unaware of such character. So once that threshold has been met, then all the evidence comes in. That's what the Barnes case essentially holds. So this is just a red herring to say, well, at that time, no self-defense was established. And even if we waited to, and the defendant's testimony did not add anything to the concealed weapon conviction. As I stated earlier, he did not state, and he did not know there was any prior concealed weapon convictions that he had. So I don't, again, that's another red herring. That is not relevant to the issue before the court. Thank you very much. We ask you to reverse.
Thank you. We'll come back.
Thank you.
All
right.